number 9 or number 7.
Major Jefferson, reel 7. When you first encountered the enemy coming over Ruisat Ridge and down the side of it, were you fully aware of the location and strength of other friendly forces in the vicinity?
Me personally, F.R. Jefferson, no. I knew nothing other than the fact that I was backstop Charlie and that the guns of 11th Field Regiment were in front of me. If you mean was the commander, was my colonel, I don't know. If you mean was the commander of Robcol, I can tell you pretty exactly how he felt, because he'd just received some orders the day before to organise two columns from the remains of 1st 4th Essex, another regiment, and the 11th Field Regiment RA, and any other guns I could get, to quote his own diary. The other regiment wasn't battle-worthy, and 1st 4th Essex at that time consisted of one company only. That was C Company. The others were being brought up, some from Cairo area, others were being recollected after the breakout from Matru. So you asked me on the last reel, I think, what Robcol consisted of when it marched out. According to Rob Waller's own diary, by 1600 hours on the 1st of July, he had formed one column of 1st 4th Essex less one company. In fact, it was less two companies, because one company was still in the rear. 11th Field Regiment, 12 guns, and a small HQ. They moved off at 1600 hours to point 95, that's the rear end of the Ruisat Ridge, the eastern end, with 11th Field and one company of Essex, the remainder not being ready. He contacted General Ramsden and Leaguered, and was ordered to report to General Ramsden at 0700 hours next morning. He knew then that the 18th Indian Brigade had been attacked and overrun in the Air El Shine that afternoon. That is confirmed by his brigade major's diary. He talks about 0.97 instead of 0.95, because he was probably on a different map, where we spent the night. And news arrived in his diary also that 18th Brigade box in the Alamein line had been evacuated. So they knew that there was a hole in the middle of the line. We all knew, of course, that the South Africans were to the north of us, because we left them there. We knew that the New Zealanders were somewhere to the south of us, and we knew that there were mobile columns somewhere to the south of us. There actually were 5th Indian Division. But I certainly hadn't... I don't think I had a map. And I'm not even certain whether the colonel had a good map. I think he had a map. But the answer to your question is, in essence, no, except that we knew that in front of us there was a bloody great hole. Yeah.
Do you remember whether this produced a feeling of isolation at the time?
Yes and no. I can remember being very isolated because I was backstop Charlie, you know, and all the regiment were in front of me. I think we knew we were the only people on that ridge when eventually 11th HAC came up behind us, and later in the day the armour brigade collected to our left rear. The HAC were extremely helpful, and the armour brigade were at first they weren't all that popular for what they did that afternoon, except for one thing, which we can talk about later, when they did a rather gay charge. Yes, I think we were perhaps conscious of being isolated. Whether we were particularly depressed at our isolation, I don't remember, but I don't think so.
As Backstop Charlie, what did you actually have under your immediate control?
I must have had my own... It would be a 1500 weight as command post officer, and the LAD, the light aid detachment, must have been somewhere around, because they would be the very backstop, because they would bring up all the crocs, and that's all. I don't think when the balloon went up that the regiment were all that far ahead of me, but they can't have been, because otherwise that airburst would have been at fair range. I can see the airburst today right up there, and it was a very loud split. It was a quite different noise to the noise one had got accustomed to in France, oddly enough. It was almost a crack, more like a whip crack, whereas in France it was more boom. They were, in France they used mortars, big mortars a great deal more. This was definitely, I would think, an 88 airburst.
Is it possible that the sound was altered by the atmospheric conditions?
Yes, it is, quite likely, because of course there's nothing to break it in the desert.
From your truck, how many other vehicles of Robcol could you actually see?
I've no idea. It would vary as you went over a ridge anyway. Sometimes none, sometimes a large amount of dust in front of you. No idea.
When you actually saw the airburst, at that point, have you any idea how many vehicles were roughly within your line of sight and were visible?
I don't remember any, but that doesn't mean that there weren't any.
What was your immediate reaction to this airburst? Did you have...
Panic! it was such a cracking noise. I can remember... I can feel the difference today between it and what one had gone through in France. I imagine that one's natural reaction would be to try and close up with the column. I don't know. Indeed, my next knowledge is of being on the ridge with the troops the other side of, on the forward crest, and us scrabbling to try and hack some sort of command post out of this wretched rock. And the buggy, the battery commander, standing over me and asking things like, "Are you through my line?" And I don't think at that time we were.
One presumes that you did have standing orders about what to do if you came under fire while on the move.
I don't think we needed them. Everyone had his place in the order of things, and one took it up. If one had had standing orders, they were probably written in India 2 years before. They certainly weren't any received after we left Iraq.
It sounds as though then, after seeing the airburst, you went up onto the ridge and started digging in.
Onto the ridge itself, onto a slight ridge under the ridge. The ridge was always to my right, to my north, throughout that day.
So you're on a subsidiary terrace then, coming away?
Yes, and the desert is all ripples, and the guns would be on the forward slope somewhere in front of me.
So they'd be on the north side?
No, they were on the south side, they're facing west, and I was on the eastern slope. The Germans, don't forget, were coming round. If that's the ridge, and here's the Deir al-Shain, and there we are. The Germans were coming round here at that time. Later they came over the ridge.
So initially they were coming round.
The primary thrust initially was of infantry marching on the south side of the ridge like we were.
So they're advancing southeast.
Yeah,
then.
There were obviously Germans on the ridge, because one would automatically secure one's flank there. But in fact, I think that it's fairly clear from all the reports that there were German columns on the north side of the ridge and the south side of the ridge, and people actually holding the top of the ridge. But they were mainly lorried infantry in the morning, and it was then that Captain Clements, commander of Don Troop, had a very good shoot against these lorried infantry coming to the south, along the southern slopes of the ridge, as we were coming along the southern slopes the other way. And it was there that I had my major moment of panic, because one had gone into action expecting a tank battle, and suddenly gun control, and suddenly Clem called for battery fire, and I hadn't, because we were marching us to a tank battle, I hadn't actually linked the troops, which is the command post officer's chief job, but of course I was coming up as backstop Charlie anyway. And he called for battery fire, so thank God, after a moment of panic, I remembered the gunner's rule, which is that at 6,000 yards, 100 yards subtends 1 degree. And if at that time E Troop were a bit behind and to the left rear of D Troop, and Don Troop were doing the ranging, it only needed a quick calculation to say something like E Troop add 200 yards right or more 3 degrees. I can't remember whether at that stage of the war we were saying more 3 degrees or right 3 degrees. I have an idea we were still on the right 3 degrees system, but a little mental calculation would bring the two approximately onto the right target. But that was a bad moment, I must confess.
When you mentioned gun control or battery fire, presumably you meant on gun control, guns firing individually at targets.
Later on, I expected from the beginning that they would be firing over open sights, in effect. Yeah.
Direct fire.
Yeah.
Tanks.
And indeed, later on in the afternoon, when the OPs came in, that was the order that was given: tanks approaching, gun control, and then the individual numbers one take on the tanks over open sights. But in the morning, it turned out to be a much more normal battle than I'd expected, and we fired away in perfectly normal procedure of a battery on almost any day in the war, engaging troops from OP control.
How far away from the guns were the enemy lorried infantry when they opened up on them?
I have a figure of 2,900, but I have an idea that was for the afternoon battle. It may have been appreciably more in the morning when I think it over. Possibly 6,000 or 7,000 yards, I don't know. But looking at the map, I should think Clem would open up at 6,000 or 7,000 yards at first, in the first contact. But as I say, I was not there when that started. And when I did get involved in it, I was in a certain amount of sweat.
From the moment you were told that you needed to have battery control, how long did it take you to establish communication with all the different troops of guns ahead of you?
Well, my control, my contact would normally just be with D Troop and E Troop on the battery command post, and then a line would come in from RHQ. And I know that lines were laid that morning, because I know that originally the commander of E Troop had a great deal of trouble with his I think it was a 101 set we had in those days, and he actually had to come in from the OP and change his set. I can't remember which orders came via line and which by RTOC or WTOC, but both worked at some stage in the day.
You mentioned digging in the the control post, were you able to actually get undercover?
No. One can just scramble a few rocks around and perhaps scrape 6 inches here and there. But that particular bit of desert was extremely hostile.
How far ahead of you were the guns? Two troops.
They ought not to have been more than about 400 yards. I suspect they were perhaps a little further. Originally, when we went into action, 83-85 battery, the battery I was in, was on the right, closest to the ridge, and 78-84 battery was on the left, further down in the valley. And originally, Don Troop was on the right of Easy Troop. In other words, Don was closest to the ridge and forward. I was, I would think, therefore, working it out backwards rather than from a distinct memory, appreciably closer to Easy Troop than to Don Troop in their first position. And I remember going forward with ammunition later in the battle, and it would be 400 or 500 yards at least in front of my command post where I dumped the ammunition on that occasion.
So, Don Troop was higher up on the slope.
Yeah.
Easy Troop was echeloned back on their left.
Yeah. And I would be more or less halfway between the two, but because of the echelon, I'd be nearer Easy Troop than.
What about RHQ? Was that
RHQ? I don't remember, but one of my correspondents places it as being to the right rear of me. But I don't remember it being there. And it's quite possible, in fact, that it was simply a mobile that the colonel's Z-truck with the pink gin palace signal thing was RHQ that day.
So who's roaming about trying to sort out problems as they arose?
That's how I visualise him, but I personally don't remember seeing them at any stage.
Could you actually see the guns from your control?
Not from my command post, no, because they were on the forward slope and I was on the reverse slope. The only time I saw the guns was when I went up with the ammunition at a critical stage in the afternoon, but...
Had they managed to get themselves dug in and protected?
No. They, by the time they'd fired off a few cases of charges, they were using the charge cases filled with sand in place of sandbags.
So just a case of trail.
But the injuries that day were almost entirely caused by... Well, no, not entirely. One was a direct hit. But were largely caused by splinters coming underneath the shield.
But I think you were saying earlier on that happened in the afternoon rather than in the morning. So the...
In the morning... Well, in the morning...
In the morning it was the infantry attack.
At one stage, there is general agreement in the diaries that Rob Waller ordered Don Troop back. Because it was suffering casualties. And the balance of evidence is that this was done in the morning when they were under observed gunfire. Certainly Don Troop had number one gun hit, a direct hit, which didn't actually... lay everyone flat, and the surviving gunners were spread amongst the other guns, and then number three gun received a direct hit and Sergeant Eggleston in charge of it was mortally wounded, and numbers 1, 2 and 4 were then pulled back behind E Troop. The exact timing of that I'm not 100% certain of, but all the evidence suggests it was in the morning rather than join the actual tank battle itself.
Do you know what sort of fire was directed at them? What sort of guns the Germans were using to knock them out?
At that moment, every instinct tells me it must have been observed fire from a battery of guns. What those guns at that moment were, I don't know. But what I do know is that when Wilkinson in E Troop was hit on the head later by a spent bit of shell, he picked it up, and it was a 25-pounder nose cap. So at least part of the time we were being fired on by 25-pounders, which had been captured by the Germans, of course, elsewhere. I have a very vivid description of that somewhere in these papers from Wilkinson himself.
What about your command post? Did that come under any control fire?
Not as such, no. And the airbursts, there were still the other airbursts around, and there were things that went whistle. But no, we weren't. We were just an attempt at holding the ground, not as big as this room, nowhere near as big as this, more like the size of that table.
Now, you mentioned the infantry. Did you actually see anything of them in the morning?
I personally didn't, but again, my correspondents have. The Don troop certainly have member of the command. The troop leader of Don troop writes about the infantry being in front of his guns at one stage later in the day, and there's a very vivid description in one of the letters I've got of one of the infantry carriers. This is pretty effective, the RSM, and this was fairly late on in the battle, coming past and picking up wounded. And I went some years later to an Essex reunion and met a chap who lost his arm just in front of the guns. So the position of 1st 4th Essex is very clearly established, even though I personally didn't go on the wrong side of the ridge to have a look.
So they were being used to give immediate protection to the guns?
Yes, they were simply rifles and a Bren gun or two and a carrier or two. And they were there simply to shoot off people who came on foot. And of course they had a very rough time because they were as exposed as the guns but didn't have any joy of firing back. And I asked one chap what he did during the battle, and he said that he spent several hours watching two beetles making love.
Did any of the motorised infantry try and actually get to you in the morning's battle?
Oh, well, I mean, they tried to get to us. They didn't get close enough to us. But I think it was a result of their attack and the shelling that preceded it or came with it that Don troop and B troop in the other battery suffered casualties and were pulled back. But they, I don't think in the course of the day troops actually got closer than I have one estimate of 300 yards, but I would think it was further than that to be exact. I think it was probably 500-600 yards were the nearest they actually got to the guns. It didn't make them any less frightening for that.
How far away could you actually see an individual infantryman in the desert?
An individual infantryman. That's a very good question. It wasn't the infantryman I was looking at most of the time, it was the other OP. And, oh dear. I think, Of course, it varies so much. I mean, there were times you can see them at 25 yards, like a London fog. There were times when you would see him 25 foot high because of the mirage. But you could see him several hundred yards away, clearly, on in good light. But the big thing about this, of course, was that you had so few points of reference that judging range was extremely difficult until you were at home there. And then it varied from hour to hour.
What colour was the desert?
I'm not very good on colours, but it was the colour one would expect a desert to be. It was a dunny sort of brown with little patches of black or dark, very dark green camel form. And often looked like water, I say, with a mirage.
You mentioned you had a fair number of wounded due to the enemy shelling in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened to them? How were they dealt with?
This is slightly difficult, because I think we ought to have had, I think we probably started out with an Indian, 10th Indian Division medical unit. But certainly when we got into the real action, it was the medical officer of 11th Field who was the only organised medical man on the battlefield, and Sergeant Tideman from RHQ was at one stage in the afternoon detailed to organise relief for the wounded. I've got his description somewhere. And he speaks of the MO, Dr. Cameron, it was Dr. Cameron at that time, operating in the back of a three-tonner. And he speaks of limbs and things lying around like a butcher's shop. I know that I've already mentioned the Essex carrier that evacuated some of the wounded from the from the leading troop. If you just stop it a second, I can find you a. Here is one description from David Tideman, who was the artillery.